This week on Texas Scorecard Radio, Texas teachers up in arms over waste in state government, and some candidates running for Congress have never voted before. Find out which ones those are. In our interview, we talked to David Blott with Right on Healthcare about the Personalized Care Act and what it would mean for your family. And in this week's commentary, Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us about the effort to take away your right to vote on judges. Welcome back, friends, to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas. As always, if you want to find me on social media, you can follow me at TweetTonyMac. And we're available on the internet at www.texasscorecard.com. Lots of articles going up there. Of course, this show is not just a radio show. It goes out as a podcast. So if you're not already subscribed, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, basically every podcasting platform. You can subscribe and make sure you never miss a program. With that out of the way, I want to talk to Brandon Walton's managing editor for Texas Scorecard. We've had an article up that's just blowing up about retired teachers up in arms over waste at the state's retired teacher investment fund.
It's absolutely amazing. The teacher retirement system of Texas, this is the fund that when you talk about teachers or college professors or other educators in the state, this is where their retirement is, right? And this is the folks that look after those investments. Well, it comes out that they're moving offices. They're in Austin. Well, they're moving offices to a new high-rise building, a swanky building that's opening up downtown just right off of 6th Street, right next to the Bar District, and they're paying almost $330,000 a month for rent.
So $330,000 a month in rent to have office space in a building on 6th Street. This is... it's completely unfathomable considering, you know, teacher salaries, retirement expectations. I mean, these are folks with kind of normal financial expectations. $326,000 a month on office space, just insane.
Well, not only that, Tony, but when you look at what's been going on over the last several years with the teacher retirement system and their fund, I mean, it's been underperforming. They've come to the legislature every couple of years and lobbied and warned that, you know, it could potentially go insolvent. This is something that teachers, and specifically retired teachers, have shown a lot of concern about. And then you have this story, and I think this is why the story is blowing up so much right now, is that you have retired teachers and current teachers that have looked at this system and said, hey, some reforms need to be made. Maybe they've been looking at the legislature for that. And then they actually go and see how that money is being spent.
Yeah, you know, there's this temptation. You see this across the board in state government where we have this temptation. Hey, we've got these big pots of money that are set up for pensions, those kinds of things, and we need to invest them, and we're going to go out there and be really creative in our investments. And it just feels like it invites excess. It invites cronyism. I mean, you know, as a private investor, the general advice out there is, hey, go get an index fund, pay the absolute minimum overhead, you know, for that. Don't try and pick winners and losers. Right. Just buy kind of everything.
Which is how most people's retirement, right?
That's kind of the best thing. But here you've got this kind of an example of why that is the best case, because if you put the money in the hands of people to make selective investments, their number one investment is in, you know, primo luxury real estate for their office.
Exactly. And you look at the overhead they have. I mean, I'm almost 700 employees here in Austin. You know, there's a little bit of a rumor. It's not been substantiated completely, but that perhaps the retirement system has an investment in the building itself,
which opens in the building up on 6th
Street. another layer of questions about it. But very interesting, and very, very interesting to see teachers so up in arms about this.
Yeah, well, something they need to be paying attention to, and of course, we'll be paying attention to it ourselves.
Yes, we will.
Next, let's turn and talk to Matt Stringer, West Texas correspondent. Big story out there, a couple congressional candidates caught. Apparently, they haven't been voting or have never voted or something bizarre like that. Tell us what's going on out there.
Well, that's right, Tony, and thanks for having me on. You know, this voting saga has developed and continued from what seemed at first as a pretty unsuspecting question at a candidate forum hosted in Odessa. The congressional candidates for Congressional District 11 were asked, did you vote in the 2018 general election? It turned out, surprisingly, three missed the election. And it was whenever the candidates started giving their excuses why that it caught a whole bunch of local citizens, including my attention, to give their excuses a little bit more thorough vetting.
Yeah. So let's talk. Let's back up just a second. So this is out there in Odessa. This is the West Texas Congressional District. Tell people a little bit about where, you know, if they're sitting there going, hey, is this my congressional district? What areas is this covering?
That's right, Tony. So this is Texas's 11th congressional district. The current incumbent is Congressman Mike Conaway, who announced suddenly this past August that he was retiring from the spot and it would be an open seat.
Right.
The district runs from the New Mexico border at Andrews County, includes Midland, Odessa, San Angelo, and runs all the way up to Hood County, Granbury, Eastland, Llano, all this large area of the Hill Country. It's a fairly large district.
Big swath of Texas. So tell us about who are the candidates. So three of the candidates at the forum said, hey, we didn't vote in 2018. And it turns out like some of them haven't voted in previous elections. Tell us who they are and what they're saying.
Sure. So the first candidate to respond that he didn't vote was Mr. Jamie Berryhill of Odessa. And he said that he has voted in every election before that, but that particular one, he was in the middle of changing his home address and just because of paperwork or some other reasons could not make that particular election. And his story seemed to check out. The question then went to candidate August Pfluger. And Pfluger, he served as a Air Force pilot. I believe he's now retired and attained the rank of lieutenant colonel. And he said that the reason that he did not vote was that as a member of the military, he could not give an impression that he was partisan or biased. And it was a very lengthy excuse that a lot of people described as being made up on the spot.
That's pretty bizarre because, you know, yes, military people aren't allowed to necessarily engage in partisan politics, but they, you know, we go through all this effort to make sure that the ballots are, you know, it's like the biggest hurdle in all of our elections is making sure we get ballots out to service members. So they're clearly allowed and encouraged to vote.
Sure. And interestingly enough, three other candidates are also military veterans, two other Air Force veterans, and they responded that they not only voted, but they always vote. And one Air Force veteran that's a candidate even went so far as to say that he believes it's not only a right, but a duty to vote.
Yeah. So who's the third guy in addition to Pfluger?
The third candidate was Brandon Batch of Midland, and he gave an interesting excuse. He said that he was working as a congressional staffer for Representative Michael McCaul at the time in Washington, D.C., and he'd been sent abroad to meet with foreign dignitaries on behalf of Representative McCaul, and because he was out of the country at the time, he was unable to participate in the election.
So, and you've looked into this. Is this really checking out?
So it turned out after further investigation that not only had Batch and Pfluger not voted in 2018, but they were never registered to vote in their lives until October of 2019. So that means they didn't vote for President Trump in 2016 and all of the elections before then.
Wow. That's really a crazy thing. Something I think Texans, if you're looking at your congressional candidates, you go, huh, maybe I need to go check some voting records and see. You just assume that these folks are voting. But that's a really amazing discovery out there. Thanks for your reporting on it.
Thank you, Tony.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
While the far-left candidates are on the march with their plans for big government healthcare solutions or problems masquerading as solutions, but conservatives do have alternative ideas, some good ideas out there. And to talk about those, I've got this week's guest, David Bilott, with Texas Public Policy Foundation, director of the Right on Healthcare initiative there. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, look. Most of the healthcare debate that we hear is dominated by the left, dominated by ideas of doing single payer programs, modeling our healthcare system on European countries. These are the things that get talked about a lot. But there are some proposals out there coming from the right that say, hey, here's ways that we can actually improve things for people, increase innovation, lower costs. And one of these, I just saw a release from TPPF. This Personalized Care Act. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and then maybe some of these issues generally. Tell us what's going on with this Personalized Care Act.
Absolutely. It's a bill that was put forward by Senator Cruz and Senator Braun, and there is now a companion in the House from Representative Chip Roy and a few other congressmen that are sponsoring it, and we're very pleased with what they want to accomplish. They're looking to create some equality with amongst patients, amongst employees, people in this country, with the employers. Employers have had tax advantages for a very long time, and they're creating a level playing field so that people can become consumers again in healthcare, and that's what's been missing.
It's a weird thing that we have in our healthcare market that it's so dominated by employer-based healthcare, and in fact, the critics of our healthcare system, complain about this. Oh, it has issues of portability. You want to change jobs and suddenly you have to go through a whole rigmarole about healthcare. And I think I look at that, I go, you're absolutely right. But why did this happen? Where did this come from? It turns out it's a government created problem.
A Democratic president created wage freezes in the wake of World War II. They froze wages in this country. You could not increase the wages of an employee. So what would you do to be competitive? You had to offer benefits. And so they offered employers a lot of freedom in what benefits they could get. There were tax advantages. They really expanded upon that. And so because benefits then became a product of your employment, that's what has resulted today in the pre-existing condition problem. If benefits belong to the individual and they can take it with them from job to job, you've got no pre-existing condition issue. So it's funny to me that a Democrat president created a problem that Democrats now are wanting to they're basically asking for a bailout, but they're also winning elections based on this premise that they created.
Yeah, so, well, let's talk a little bit about that. You're right. They're winning elections because the every solution becomes a problem in terms of driving up cost. I mean, obviously, folks remember the Obama administration. President Obama says, hey, we're going to do Obamacare, and this is going to lower costs. And, I don't think there's any – there's probably no one listening to this show who has experienced a reduction in cost. It's gone up pretty much across the board. Can you tell us a little bit about that problem? And it's a serious problem for affordability and access to health care.
Well, affordability is the number one issue on the minds of Americans. And let's back up just a bit and say that this isn't just a problem that's acknowledged by conservatives. It's acknowledged by every candidate running for president, with the exception of perhaps Vice President Biden. They all want to go to a single payer. They want a Medicare for all. Why? Because the current system isn't working and it's unaffordable. For them to say otherwise is disingenuous. So they recognize that it's a problem as well. Premiums have gone up 2 to 3 times. Deductibles have gone up 5 to 6 times. You're looking at huge multiples that have created more uninsured people because they simply cannot afford it. If you look at the people that participate on the exchange, even if they have a complete subsidy and their premiums are $0 for them, With most people in this country not having $1,000 in their savings account, what does it matter if I have a $4,000 deductible?
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's if you're got a subsidized rate and you still have a deductible, well, that isn't really going to do you much good, because if you're the kind of person who's being subsidized, that means you don't really have the means to pay the deductible.
Yeah, they are functionally uninsured.
Interesting.
And you know, they have a pretty insurance card in their wallet, but it doesn't get them much.
So, I mean, let's go back to this Personalized Care Act. I mean, my understanding is there are certainly tax advantages that are offered to employers, and that's why you continue to see healthcare routed through employers. What would this do to change that situation?
Well, right now the contribution limits are pretty meager. It's only $2,500. That doesn't even cover a deductible these days. And mind you, the limits were set back in the day when these were on the high end. That just goes to show how much more expensive things have become. But it increases the limits to a little over $10,000 for an individual and nearly $30,000 for a family, which is consistent with what people are paying today. Premiums, on average, are close to $24,000 a year before their deductible even becomes an issue. So it increases those contribution limits pre-tax. It also allows people to make those payments to premiums. That's not something that they could ever have done before. So it frees up that restriction. It includes different types of qualified medical expenses, like direct primary care.
So what is that? I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, we're talking about people being able to pay their doctors directly, or is this concierge medicine? What is that?
Well, concierge medicine is something a little bit differently. Direct primary care is a great innovation that has really grown over the years. I personally use it. And what it is, it's a membership model. Let's think about in terms of a gym membership. It's a relatively inexpensive rate, usually between $60 and $80 a month, for unlimited access to a primary care physician. And you can talk to them in person, over the phone, FaceTime, app, however you want to do that. But it reestablishes that doctor-patient relationship. And what we do here at Right On Healthcare, the mission behind how we think about healthcare is this. If you look at the basic unit of what healthcare is, it's that relationship between medical professional and patient.
Right.
And the reason that healthcare has become so expensive and inaccessible and decreasing in quality is because there are so many middlemen, government being one of the bigger ones, that have injected themselves between the parties in that relationship.
Well, and also, you know, when I look at it, it's so often the case that you have no idea what anything is going to cost. So are these changes of allowing folks, obviously, to put money into HSAs and have tax-deductible, you know, spending on their health care, shouldn't this actually create the innovation to actually lower cost, because you actually have some price responsiveness?
That's correct. So, you know, I'll go back to my personal example. I'm happy to share. I have two, adult children in their early 20s, and we use a cost-sharing model for catastrophic types of coverage, and we have direct primary care. So with the equivalent of a $1,500 deductible, if something bad were to happen to me or a family member, I pay just under $500 a month, and that includes unlimited access to a primary care physician.
Hmm. And like, I think a lot of people, I mean, you think about it, I'm trying to think of my situation, and I have a law office and employ folks, and so, you know, you're putting in more than that into insurance plans, and then you're still having to pay up to a deductible for all of those doctor visits and those kinds of things. So that's actually in line with, that could be a very good deal if you're actually getting your day-to-day treatment taken care of through a direct arrangement, and then having that insurance as a backstop whenever, you know, something in case something catastrophic takes place.
Well, and more employers are taking advantage of that model as well. Here in Texas, there's a restaurant chain called Rudy's, and the owner of that organization actually testified before the state legislature, and he was talking about how he was going to have to stop providing benefits to his employees, even though he'd been doing it from the very beginning because it was important to him. but the cost of healthcare had exceeded the cost of his product, and it just didn't make any sense anymore. So he, rather than giving it up, he changed and he tried an innovative model, which was this direct primary care in conjunction with a few other things. And he said he cut his cost in half, which was surprising and significant, but everybody has been even happier with the service that they're getting.
Yeah, yeah, it's an improvement in care, and, you know, it's cheaper. So tell me about this. I saw seen on the site there's an executive order that's come down from the Trump administration, and it actually touches on this issue about allowing individual employees to purchase health care, you know, through an employer-based program, but actually allowing them to choose as opposed to having something imposed on them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly. That's the health reimbursement arrangement. It became effective January 1st of this year. It was part of the choice and competition report that came out of the administration. Many of those initiatives have been very good, very positive. They've been stalled to some degree by all of the lawsuits. And we have not yet seen any lawsuits on this HRA initiative, but I'm sure that will be forthcoming in a few months, unfortunately. But the way it works is employers can allocate a certain dollar amount. So if they were spending, you know, $500 a month on their portion, rather than just continue in the status quo, they're going to take, you know, that $400 or $500 and put it into an account for that employee, and that employee would then have to go shop for ACA eligible types of plans, because this EO still was under the auspices of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
Sure.
It still had to be those types of plans.
Yeah, but that's still something that would create another option. It kind of makes me think of the Rudy situation, where you have an employer who wants to, you know, provide this benefit to their employees, but just is getting priced out of the market from it even being economically feasible. It seems like it at least opens up. And it seems like the kind of thing that would work very well in conjunction with this Personalized Care Act, if we're going to, you know, free employers up to provide health care, you know, through just a stipend or something like that. You know, that's something good. Put money in people's pockets and then let them actually go out and pay for the health care that they need and that makes sense for their family. It seems like a common sense reaction to this sort of thing.
Yeah, there's no question that it would be helpful. And the projection is that this would really bolster the individual market. The individual market was decimated in the advent of Obamacare. But having the HRA, if enough employers are going this way, it will bring the individual market back, and it'll be competitive because they're going to have more people to try to compete for.
Yeah.
As opposed to these big employers, they're going to have all the employees that have this cash that they're wanting to spend on health benefits.
Yeah, so I think
that make it easy to understand, affordable, and accessible.
Yeah, I think that's the answer, is to put more power in the hands of patients, families who are actually making these decisions, so that they can make wise decisions, and you actually create a healthcare market better than what we have today. Well, we're running out of time, but tell folks who are listening, if they want to connect with you, learn a little bit more about what y'all are doing at Right on Healthcare there at TPPF, how do they reach out?
Well, everything we write ends up on our website. Feel free to go to our website at texaspolicy.com, and you can look under the healthcare section, and it'll bring up all of our research, all of our op-eds. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my handle is David Balot, HC, HC for healthcare, and feel free to reach out to me personally if you have any questions or you have a story you'd like to tell or you'd just like to participate in our effort.
Great. Appreciate the work y'all are doing. Thanks for joining us, David.
Hey, thank you.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire, Vice President of Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. The 2020 election will be here before we know it, and with every election comes candidates that need to be vetted and tested before we can entrust them with our vote. At TFR, we take that vetting process seriously. Any candidate seeking our endorsement must first fill out a comprehensive questionnaire, then sit for an interview with our staff. We then seek input from each candidate's would-be constituents before making a decision. To find out more about our endorsement process and view which candidates have made the cut, visit empowertexans.com/endorsements.
There's an organized effort on right now to take away your right to vote on Texas judges. Empower Texan CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan touches on that in this week's commentary.
The Texas Constitution guarantees Texans the right to select their judges at the ballot box. But in recent years, it's become fashionable in crony elitist circles to denigrate Texas' method of judicial selection. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary. I mean, you got to understand the criticism. You can't trust mere citizens with the courts, right? Well, during the 2019 legislative session, the House and Senate voted for and the governor signed legislation creating a commission to study Texas's judicial selection process. Only 11 members of the House and 6 members of the Senate opposed the legislation. This commission is comprised of several House and Senate members, as well as individuals appointed by the governor, lieutenant governor, and House Speaker. At the commission's first meeting 2 weeks ago, several appointed members let it slip they wanted to remove the party label from judges. That's been put forward in the past as the first step to taking judicial slots off the ballot altogether. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick quickly and correctly rejected that notion. After all, the Republican Party of Texas platform explicitly calls for protecting the rights of citizens to elect judges. Those who want to end judicial elections say judges should be independent of the electorate. But why? The citizens are sovereign in our republic, not the judiciary. Yes, the judiciary should be independent of the executive and legislative branches, but all three branches should be subservient to the law and the citizens. It's more correct to say that judges should have the courage to be accountable to the voters, to lay out their qualifications to sit in judgment of their fellow citizens, and risk being removed from office should they let their personal biases be put ahead of the citizens. Several states use nonpartisan commissions comprised mostly of lawyers to select judges. Typically, such commissions have resulted in a more liberal judiciary, even if it is nonpartisan by label. Such commissions and selection panels become quickly captive to big law firms, big business, and the capital bureaucracy. Such a system forces those who would be judges to seek the approval of capital insiders and cronies rather than the citizenry. Speaking in Austin last fall to the Texas Chapter Conference of the Federalist Society, which is an organization of conservative and libertarian attorneys, Professor Brian Fitzpatrick of Vanderbilt argued Texans should reject proposals to implement judicial nominating commissions. According to research that Professor Fitzpatrick published in the Vanderbilt Law Review, judicial nominating commissions produce a judiciary that is more liberal than the populations they serve. This happens, he suggests, because lawyers are significantly more liberal than the population at large. Moreover, practicing attorneys, particularly those involved in the State Bar Association, typically wield outsized authority on judicial nominating commissions. Nonpartisan elections produce similar results, with voters electing judges who are significantly more liberal than the population at large. They're also criticized for depriving voters of important information about the ideological views of judicial candidates. Whatever flaws exist in electing the judiciary, well, those flaws are only magnified and twisted in a commission selection process. The surest way for Texans to lose our right to elect judges would be for us to stop participating in judicial races. We need to be asking more and more direct questions of those men and women who seek to don the black robe and take up the gavel. We need to press them harder and not let ourselves be intimidated by the titles. Just like presidents, governors, and school board members, judges are supposed to work for the people and should be answerable to the people. Be on the lookout against politicians who want to take away your right to elect judges. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's all the time I have this week. As always, there's more stories than we can ever touch here on Texas Scorecard Radio up at texasscorecard.com. Updates on the refugee story we touched on last week and many more. So go check those out. Again, texasscorecard.com. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.